Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Yacht Racing Podcast with me, your host, Justin Chisholm. My guest on this episode is British Olympian and Volvo Ocean Race skipper Ian Walker. Ian has had a broad and illustrious career in professional sailing, having won two Olympic silver medals, one as a crew and one as a helmsman, and having skippered Abu Dhabi Ocean Racing to victory in the 2014-15 Volvo Ocean Race around the world. He's also led America's Cup campaigns, and he coached fellow Brit Shirley Robertson and her Yingling team to an Olympic gold medal, as well as successfully plying his trade for many years as a tactician on the International Grand Prix racing circuit. Most recently, though, Ian has taken on a new land-based challenge as Director of Racing at Britain's Royal Yachting Association, where, amongst many other responsibilities, he's in charge of the British sailing team's Olympic prospects. Our interview took place on an, at times, echoey Skype connection shortly after the Christmas and New Year break. So, Ian Walker, welcome to the podcast. Where am I talking to you today?
I'm sat in RYA headquarters in Hamble, near Southampton in the UK.
So you're there because your role these days is as racing director for the Royal Yachting Association. Just tell us a bit about that role and what attracted you to it in the first place.
Yeah, well, I guess life's changed for me quite a lot in the last 18 months. I've gone from full-time professional sailor, I guess, for the best part of 25 years. And I took this opportunity to become the director of racing at the RYA. So I kind of wear two hats. One is in charge of the performance program, the Olympic program, and the pathways of the youth and junior program that feeds that. And then the other hat is around anything else to do with racing boats in the UK. So that could include, you know, race official training and management, umpiring, certification of boats, measurement, a whole host of technical resources that the RYA provide, along with things like the Portsmouth yardstick, handicapping system, and that extends out into team racing, match racing, keelboat sailing. So pretty wide remit, and I guess that is the answer to the question of what attracted me to the role. I spent a lot of time sailing with some incredible people and amazing boats all over the world. Had a very privileged life, really, but kind of felt that the time was right to take on a new challenge, and it's certainly been a lot of challenge in the last year.
I'm sure it has. And just for those people who are listening to the podcast outside of the UK, and we do have quite a lot of listeners around the world, the RYA, the Royal Yachting Association, it's essentially the UK's governing body for sailing, isn't it? Just explain a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely right. The RYA is the national governing body for sailing. Just to put it in perspective, in my department, which is racing, which is separate from, say, other departments such as training or sports development, i.e. getting people into the sport. So in my department of racing, we have about 35 full-time staff. And then obviously there's a lot more – well, not obviously. We have a lot more contractors who work with us, particularly delivering services like coaching, mainly across our youth and junior program, but obviously also extending into the Olympic program.
And the state of racing in the UK right now, how would you sum that up?
Well, it's had quite a decline, particularly in the recession, sort of in the late 2000s. It's probably, broadly speaking, stable over the last 4 or 5 years. But there's no doubt the sport faces a lot of challenges with the changes in modern society. I think there's a lot of issues that need confronting around accessibility in terms of both the shortest resources that probably people have are time and money, and sailing, you know, can be both expensive and very time consuming. So, you know, I think we're facing quite a lot of challenges, but, you know, there's still areas of a very strong popularity and growth. We have some very successful sailing clubs, some very successful sailing series, but that's not the pattern across the board, and particularly in the UK, so in the United Kingdom, you know, we've seen probably more of a polarization of sailing in the south and in the south coast of England than maybe historically, you know, what was there 20, 30 years before.
Is there a sport that you terrible echo on this line. Is there a sport where you think, a sport that you think is doing it particularly well, that's of kind of comparable size to sailing?
Well, there's certainly sports that are struggling. I think, you know, golf, I guess, is a similar sport that is quite time consuming. And my understanding is that's had, you know, quite a decline. I think sports that are growing are more perhaps lifestyle type sports. You know, I think surfing, you know, thinking of the water environment, surfing, stand up paddle boarding, you know, sports that are maybe closer engaged, you know, closer related to health and fitness while still taking part on the water. I think they've seen considerable growth. So maybe there's some lessons we can learn from them.
Yeah, and I guess sailing does still have this image of a slightly elitist sport, and you know, I guess the sailing club, yacht club kind of mentality is still a challenge for some people and can be a barrier. Do you think that's the case?
I think sailing has that perception which creates challenges for the sport and the perception of the sport. But I think actually at a club level, that's the exception, not the rule. Most clubs that I visit around the UK are pretty down to earth, very, you know, local based clubs. And so it's not what you necessarily witness on the ground.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. Ian, I wanted to zone in with you on one element of your role, and that's the Olympic side of things. Now, you're a double Olympic medalist yourself, and, you know, obviously the Olympic side is something that's very close to your heart. Do you look back on your Olympic campaigning kind of fondly at this stage?
I'm trying desperately hard not to say things like this is how we used to do it, because, you know, it was quite a while ago. My last Olympics I competed in was 2000 in the Star, and coached the England class in 2004. So, you know, that's already stretching back three or four Olympics. So, you know, things move on, and as everything, whether it's the America's Cup, the Volvo, the Olympics, the standard goes up, the attention to detail goes up, the margin for error goes down. And so for me, it's been quite exciting. I probably spent, I don't know, 12 years of my life directly campaigning in the Olympics. To actually get re-engaged with that, it is really the purest form of sailing, I think, and it's really the area where, you know, people are pushing day in, day out to the highest degree. So that's been fascinating, and there's been huge developments certainly on the sports science side of the sport. The coaching side of the sport has changed beyond recognition from when I was involved. Like I say, the standard and the demands that the sailors put on themselves and on their support team, and the size of that support team and everything that's required to resource that is really off the charts compared to, say, 20 years ago.
How do you think you would stack up against if you were campaigning, if you were the age you were back then but campaigning now, do you think you would stack up?
I think I'd stack up in some areas, but certainly if you look at 470s, which is what I spent the majority of my time sailing, you know, that class has changed beyond recognition with the change in the pumping rules. So, you know, there's such a huge emphasis now on physical fitness that I suspect I'd have done very poorly indeed. Whereas, you know, that wasn't the case. You know, sure, you had to be sailing fit, you had to be the right size, you had to be the right weight, you had to have a certain amount of stamina, but you weren't having to spend half your time in the gym, which maybe is a prerequisite now. So, you know, so that's changed. I think that, you know, across the board, I think the sailors are fitter and stronger. That probably wouldn't have played into my strengths necessarily, but, you know, ultimately it's still campaigning. You've got to make the right decisions. You've got to take people on that journey with you. You've got to make good decisions under pressure at the right time, and those things will never change.
A lot of people would view the life of an Olympic campaigner as a pretty glamorous one. You know, being funded to sail full time sounds like a pretty fun existence. What's the reality? What do you see? You know, what you, from your own experience, obviously, and now working with the campaigners from this generation, what's life really like?
Well, I think no matter how much support you get or how much resource you have, you know, you always want more. You know, your ambitions go up, your demands go up. I don't think there's anybody profiting from Olympic sailing. In fact, you know, our knowledge shows that, you know, most individuals are really dipping quite considerably still into their pocket. But of course, that's enabling them to do the last, you know, 0.5% of improvement gain, whereas back in the day when there was no real funding, you know, you were trying to scrape around just to be able to get the petrol to put in the car to go there, not for your, you know, for some detailed piece of equipment that maybe you want to experiment with, or for the level of coaching that some people are getting used to. So it's changed, but I think that the thing that hasn't changed is that the pressure that you're under and the pressure you put on yourself and the demands and trying to, you know, trying to be the best in the world when there's lots of other people, you know, trying to do the same thing. So I think the sailors work probably physically harder than we did before, but they're able to focus much more on the job in hand. They maybe don't need to, within the UK, that is, they're maybe not having to, you know, there's more support to do it, and they're maybe not having to spend as much time working out how to resource it. But you know, we have to be really careful not to generalize, because you know the really tough period in Olympic sailing is that bridge between youth and senior sailing, and although there's a lot of knowledge-based support, there's not a lot of cash support in any shape or form for sailors until they really get quite high up the ladder, and that is the real challenge, is when you step out of youth classes and then you come into the senior world, and the top 20 in the world championship can seem an awful long way away. When you step out of your 420 dinghy.
How do you spot those people? How do you identify those individuals that have got the talent? If it was football, there would be football scouts, you know, running around the country looking at youth teams and whatever. Is that how it works with sailing?
I don't know. We don't so much have scouts, but obviously the coaches are interacting with most of those sailors from a reasonably young age. So I don't think there's really much chance that somebody's going to just appear from off the radar who we've not seen at any Optimist or Topper or Mirror or Cadet event as a junior. I don't think you can get to the required standard without competing against other people of your own age in different venues in competition. So I don't think people are going to arrive unknown to us. The coaches will see that. What do you look for? Personally, I think you can learn an awful lot just by watching people in the boat, watching how, you know, particularly the helmsman, how they sit in the boat, how they trim, how they move. I think you very quickly, to my eye, can work out who has potential. And then I think the really big thing is just understanding that individual, because so much of it is about attitude and commitment and being able to, you know, recognize your, having enough confidence to believe in yourself, but also enough humility to realize how much you need to learn and have the humility to ask for help in certain areas. So but I think attitude is probably the most important thing, because a lot of what we do in the boat is, you know, is learnable. Given the right support and input and training and practice.
The British sailing team has a pretty fearsome reputation. They topped the medal table in Rio, I think, in 2016. Are you planning a repeat performance of that in Tokyo 2020?
Well, we're hoping to do better. You know, obviously we're very ambitious. We're given this funding by the government through the National Lottery in order to get medal winning success in the Olympics, and that is our mandate. That is what we're here to do, and so therefore we have to set the bar very, very high. Rio was good because we got two golds and a silver, which meant that we topped the medal table in terms of numbers of golds, number of silvers, but not in terms of number of medals. I think I'm right in saying the Kiwis might have got four medals, You know, and we've seen there's some really strong teams around at the moment, particularly the Dutch in the last year or so. You know, the French is a bit of a renaissance as well. So it gets ever harder to win those medals. Britain peaked in Beijing with 6 medals, I believe. And looking back in Sydney in 2000, we got 3 golds and 2 silver. I'm not sure if we'll ever see that kind of dominance. And if you go further back, if you look at the American team, I think medaled in every single class, I'm right in saying, in 92, either the Americans or the Spanish, one or other. I think they got 9 or 10 medals each. So I think because people are learning from other nations, because they're able to focus on maybe 1 or 2 or 3 classes, and because there's so much talent out there and coaching ability to share that knowledge, I think that the medals are getting ever harder to win. So I have no idea how we're going to do. At this stage, I do believe we'll be in contention in all 10 classes. We've qualified all 10 classes. Do I believe we'll be in the top 8 in every class? Yes, I do. But there's a huge gulf between coming 5th, 6th, or 7th and actually delivering a medal. And some of that you have control over, but a lot of things you don't have any control over. And much of it will depend on our competition. It will depend on the conditions. It will depend on whether our team manages to peak for that occasion. And that's what we're here to try and help them do.
How does the selection process work now? You've got a clearly a very strong squad in depth in many of the classes. How do you pick the people who are going to go to the games?
Well, we don't publicise our selection. That's kept in-house. The only people who know the detail of our selection are the selection committee and the sailors that apply to be part of the team. But I can say that it's a staged process, starting this spring. It's not the same for all classes. And ultimately, the job of the selection committee is to select the sailor or sailors that they believe have the maximum chance of winning gold in Tokyo. So we might see some sailors picked earlier than others, for instance. What it isn't is one regatta and the winners go to the Olympics, that's for sure.
Yeah, that would be the classic movie way of doing it, but it doesn't make a lot of sense in real life. So let's move on from the Olympics, Ian. While I've got you on, I wanted to try and pick your brains a little bit and get your view on a few of the things that are happening in the sport at the moment, and there is a lot going on. Let's start with the Volvo Ocean Race, an event that you won in 2014-15. Some big changes there, not least the introduction of the Imoca 60 class, and before that, the sale of the business, you know, from Volvo to a private management company. What are your thoughts on all of that? It's a big, big topic.
Yeah, that is a big topic. I don't know where to start, really. But I mean, well, let's start with the last race. You know, it was a fantastic finish. I was particularly pleased to see Charles winning the race, having had so many ding-dong battles with him myself in the previous race, and with friends on board. And they did an amazing job, really, considering that, you know, where they started from and some of the tasks they were trying to fulfill outside of just winning the race. I thought that the performance of the boats was really interesting. It was really interesting how Mapfre and Dongfeng got closed down as the race went on. Maybe there's some parallels with us in the last race there. I thought the drone footage really did add to the spectacle of the race from the outside. Again, the One Design boats showed their worth in terms of, you know, it seems a long time ago now that boats were breaking down and not finishing legs. And I think that is a real concern moving forward with the Imoca 60s is, you know, we might have to get used to, you know, a third of the fleet not finishing legs as seems to happen in the Imoca 60 races, even when they're sailed single-handed. So I think that's a big concern the organisers are going to have to really think about, because, you know, we need a good fleet of boats, and the whole fleet of boats preferably needs to make its way all the way around the world. And that's one thing the Volvo 65s did provide for the race. I'm not close enough really to it. I'd see to the better judgment of people as to whether the the 60 is capable, whether you're capable of using the same boat for the Vendée and the Volvo. I guess I'm quite skeptical of that, A, because the route's different, B, because I don't know how you're going to fit all those people on board. I'm disappointed that, the race is going to be changed forever, really. I don't think we're going to have, teams of people on deck braving the elements 24 hours a day. I just don't think it works like that in the open 60s. It's a much more protected environment, more furling sails, fewer people, like it or not. It's not really a fully crewed race anymore. It's a shorthanded race. I don't know whether they're going to have five or six, but even if you've got six, in reality, probably only got half on deck. It really is shorthanded sailing, which is a shame. But please don't think I'm being critical, because I don't have a better answer to the problem. I think it's economics, really. And we all love to look back to the heyday of Maxis. Maybe the Whitbread 60s was the heyday of the race, but it's just not economically viable to be run like that anymore. And what the 60s will give us, I think, is an amazing spectacle. We've just got to hope that they get the teams to the start line and it doesn't become a complete development race, and we lose the tight racing that we've just got used to with the 65s. And B, I just hope that the boats don't break down. I do worry that when you put, a group of Volvo sailors on those boats, and they have a habit of breaking things, I suspect.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty sure I agree with you on all of those angles. And it was interesting to have a conversation with somebody who I probably shouldn't name, but an ex-leader of the Volvo Ocean Race, who was questioning this idea that speed is necessarily what we should be focusing on with this sport. Having just had this amazing race in perhaps not the fastest boats on the planet with the 65s, but super racing and very engaging for all the fans, did we really need to move it into foiling boats and with all the risks of that, where we may have the boats separated by big distances?
Yeah, it's just a really difficult dance, isn't it? Because, you want to attract the best sailors, and the sailors want to sail the sexiest, coolest boats, and the sailors like development because it gives them something intellectually to challenge themselves with. And I can tell you, going training on a Volvo 65 day in, day out is pretty boring, once you've got used to it. Whereas, when you're actually able to think about how could I redesign this sail, or what can we do with this widget, or what can we change on the foil, then it adds another layer of sort of intellectual involvement. And so I get it. The sailors and the industry and the designers, they all love the idea of development classes. But it's one of the sort of ironies of our sport that very often when boats get too fast, the race gets boring. And whilst the foiling boats look cool, most of the time the boats are in the middle of the ocean. Even if you look at the Olympic classes, very often the slowest classes, dare I say, at the Finn, is one of the most kind of photogenic boats, and the Star used to be as well. And that's because the people are close to the water. You can maybe, because they're going slower, it's easier to get those images. I don't think that's necessarily as true. The 49ers are not always as photogenic as the slower boats. So speed doesn't necessarily add sexiness in a way, but I do think it adds something which the race was losing. If the Volvo race doesn't attract the best sailors, then what is it? It's just another round the world race. It's really important that's heard to, and I think that when it was in the Volvo 70s, they really were cool boats, and the sailors loved sailing them. And I think it's a real shame that they moved too far away from that. And I think they're all the good things of the Volvo 65, the longevity, the close racing. I think we could have had all of that and still had a slightly faster, more reliable boat. I think the 70s were very close to getting to that point, just as we moved away from them.
Well, what's your guesstimate on how many teams we'll see building a 60 for the next race, or at least entering a 60?
I couldn't. Your guess would be way better than mine, Justin. you know, first question is it realistic to do the Vendée and the Volvo in the same boat? I suspect the answer is no. And if it was realistic, you know, what's the time gap between those races? You know, is it, what is it? You probably would be able to answer the question, but we're talking 4, 5, 6 months between the end of the Vendée and the start of the Volvo. You know, what modifications? Presumably you're going to have to put a whole new deck and superstructure on a boat to make it viable. I mean, I haven't been on board one of the modern 60s, but by all accounts, there's not much room down below. Someone said there was 4 square or 4 cubic meters on the new, the latest boat. Well, you struggle to get 6 people down there. So clearly the boat's going to have to be modified, at least the modern ones that are aiming to win the Vendée. And if you're not one of those boats, then would you want to take it in the Volvo anyway? So I don't know. I'm not close enough to it. All I know is I love the race. I think that, you know, Richard and Johan, they love the race. I like the fact the race is being run by people who are passionate about it. You know, Volvo did an amazing job, not just in the race, but across the whole breadth of our sport, really. It's moved it in an inexorably commercial direction. And I just really hope they can make a go of it. And I certainly wish them, you know, luck with that. And hopefully I'll get to go for a sail on one of the boats before they take off.
So staying with offshore sailing and just kind of dipping back into the Olympics, and I understand you may or may not be able to answer this question, what are your views on the potential introduction of an offshore class, a mixed gender offshore class for the next but one Olympics?
Well, it's you've really got to look at it. You can't really look at it in isolation. You've got to look at the whole process of how they got to that point. If I just step back and look at the array of events we potentially have for 2024, you've got to say it's kind of exciting. We've got some single handers, we've got some double handers, we've got skiffs, we've got some mixed boats, we've got offshore, we've got kite boards, we've got windsurfers. You think, you know what? If the purpose of the Olympics is to showcase the breadth of our sport to the world, that's kind of pretty cool. So in that sense, I'm quite positive. If I think about British interests, of course, we absolutely want to retain the Finn, because I think we've won the last 5 gold medals in the Finn. And we're working incredibly hard, hoping that we might be able to win the next one. I do think that in an age where humans are getting bigger, generally, certainly in the developed world, I suspect across the whole world, because of improved diets, you know, people are getting bigger. It's slightly strange that we no longer have a boat for larger men, at least. It's a victim of the process. World Sailing followed the process. I think the final decision to approve offshore sailing over the single person mixed event was the right decision, because I don't believe the Finn would have had a role to play in that anyway. And I think to have events such as single person mixed in the Olympics that don't exist outside of the Olympics would be wrong. I can see quite a lot of potential in mixed offshore, but I can also see a lot of questions. You know, how is it going to be kept affordable? How are they going to police the rules? And actually, on a really simple point, I'm nervous about the number of double-handed boats we now have, or double-handed events, with a falling athlete quota, because it means the fleet sizes are going to get smaller and smaller at the games, and that's going to have an impact on the number of countries that end up being involved. And I guess my real fear there is that was one of the main reasons why parasailing was dropped from the Olympics, because it wasn't seen to be participated. You know, it wasn't participation in enough countries and continents worldwide. So that's a bit of a concern. Whereas, you know, do we really need however many mixed events? How many mixed events do we have now? NACRA, boards, offshore, 470. So we've got 4 mixed plus double-handed skiff. And yeah, so we've got 6 double-handed events and 4 single-handed events.
Hi,
Hi there, Justin Chisholm here, host of the Yacht Racing Podcast. If you would like to advertise your brand, service or event on the podcast, you can. Just go to yachtracing.life/podcast and send me a message. I'll be in touch straight away to get the ball rolling. It's as simple as that. Send me a message at yachtracing.life/podcast and I'll be in touch. That's yachtracing.life/podcast. Got it? Good. Now back to the podcast.
I wanted to touch also on the America's Cup and Sail GP. Sail GP is the newcomer to the whole thing. It's Russell Coutts and Larry Ellison's baby. It's had lots of money ploughed into it. It looks slick. The boats look pretty impressive. Do you think the introduction of this kind of detracts from the America's Cup or is complementary to the whole thing?
I think the America's Cup's the America's Cup and it's all about the history. So I don't think it will detract from the America's Cup, I guess, is my honest opinion. I'm not that close to the whole thing. My only real involvement has been discussions with Dylan Fletcher and Stu Bithell, that is, about the impact this may or may not have on their 49er campaign, which is my interest, is winning gold medals for Great Britain in Tokyo. So, part of that discussion was around obviously their time commitment, and part of that discussion was around safety. And I just hope that they can race these boats with as little training time as they've all got, with five or six of them on the water, hoping that they can keep that safe and at the speeds that they're talking about.
I think you're right. And I guess in an ideal world, you would rather they weren't doing that and they were just focused on their Olympic campaign.
I'm not sure. I think if that was the case, then we might have sought to stop them doing it. I think there's lots of opportunities that come out of this. I think that it's really important to grow as an individual, as a sailor, and as a team. And I think this will offer a whole load of experiences that will make Dylan and Stu grow as sailors and campaigners. And if you look in the past at the likes of Pete Burling, even Giles Stott as an example, they've been able to juggle, successful gold medal winning Olympic campaigns with other sailing. And some might argue if it's managed properly, it could actually strengthen it. But I think it's a question of managing that process and being realistic with yourselves. And also, I'm a sailor. I put myself in their shoes. I can imagine how much you'd want to do that, how much you want a gold medal, but how much you want to, get involved in a new exciting project like this. So, our job's to try and manage that process and support them and help them and hopefully be successful in both.
So there are lots of options open now to successful Olympic sailors coming out of an Olympics with a medal. It used to kind of be, well, you'd get sucked into the America's Cup, but now you've got America's Cup, you've got Sail GP. You'd even look at the Volvo race, which was kind of peppered with medal winners, in the last race, and also things like the Vendée Globe now with these very high-tech, high-performance boats. So it's kind of a pretty healthy-looking situation for Olympic sailors after an Olympics.
Sort of isn't it? It's funny, isn't it? Olympic sailors are getting smaller and smaller, and yet the people required to, say, crew an America's Cup boat are getting bigger and bigger. I think it's fine if you're one of the people who is able to make that transition. But I think in general, there's fewer and fewer opportunities. I think, back in the 90s, you might have gone into the Admiral's Cup. There was many more people involved in that of all different shapes and sizes. Whereas, and that was a stepping stone to other big boat series like the 50s or maybe into the Volvo or Whitbread as it was then. Whereas I think, now it's the higher performance nature of the boats in the main events has helped, because that's, I guess, more, it's brought the average, it's brought the age down, and it's brought the Olympic sailors increase their relevance. but you know, I don't think there's an awful lot of opportunities out there. You know, the TP52, not that many opportunities open up. I think the Fast 40s is quite exciting that's going on in the UK. So I don't know. I think, you know, if you look at the size of crews, I mean, America's Cup in 2002, when I was the British skipper, I think we had 38 sailors on our sailing squad. And many people got their break through that and the Cup before. And that's how they got their experience of sailing big boats and were able to then take that on into super yachting or Volvo Ocean Race or whatever they did, further America's Cup. Whereas now, I mean, how many people were on the British sailing squad in VAR in Bermuda? It was, what, five? Is it five on the boat and another handful of, you know, in reserve? So maybe 10 in total, 10, 11, something like that, compared to 38. And of course, we had 11 teams in New Zealand. So that's like 250, nearly 300 sailors. Not all teams were two-boat teams. So I don't know. I think it's pretty tough if you're out there as a young sailor, and it's hard enough if you've got a medal, and it's even harder if you haven't.
And there is a case to argue, I guess, that certain sailors who are not Olympic medalists, who are kind of physically and, you know, talent-wise, just fit the bill. I'm thinking of people like Luke Parkinson and Louis Sinclair, who sailed with you on the Abu Dhabi race. They've been pretty much constantly employed since that Abu Dhabi campaign finished with America's Cup and various other things.
Yeah, that's for sure. If you're a young sailor now and you want to make your way in the sport, the most important thing is to get down the gym. You know, so many of the boats have become so fitness driven and strength and size driven, including the Volvo. I mean, one of the criteria we were looking for almost from the outset is you've got to be 90 kilos. You know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, why we didn't have more girls involved in the Volvo. Well, there's not that many who are over 90 kilos, which was one of my criteria when I was trying to choose the team. So, yeah, there's a huge move in that regard, a big change in the sport. And it's true all the way down, you know, all the way down in youth and junior sailing. There's a much higher emphasis put on diet, on physical preparation. And a lot of the kids are really into that stuff now.
Do Louis and Marco still take your calls, answer your emails these days?
Yeah, they're not too famous for me yet. I haven't spoken to Louis for a while, but I spoke to Parco quite recently.
Ian, just to finish off.
I think he's living over here now. I'll have to catch up with him.
That's right. Well, he had a British passport, I know, when he was with the Abu Dhabi team, so that will have been a big appeal to Ben Ainslie and the Ineos team.
You see, those guys, you know, they're physical weapons, but the other thing that really made them stand out was their attitude, and that hasn't changed. You know, they are people you want on your side, people who will do anything for the cause. They'll be first down the boat part. They'll be last to leave in the evening. You know, and that still goes an awful long way. And we shouldn't just pigeonhole people like Parco and Louis as just being about their physical size. Sure, that's got them their break, but there's plenty of big, strong people who've made a hash of it or who people don't want to have around.
You're absolutely right. Ian, just to finish off, just cast an eye over the America's Cup. From my viewpoint, it looks like it's in a reasonably healthy situation from a team point of view. It's the kind of largest entry we've had for a little while. What's your viewpoint?
Yeah, I mean, it's changed a lot, hasn't it, in the last month or so with the announcement of how many new entries were there? It was Taylor Camfield, wasn't there? It was a Dutch one. Was it two? Was it?
Yeah, it's a two.
Was there another Italian one or Malta?
That's right. Three.
Is that one or two?
So that's one from Malta, one from America, and one from, what was the other one? The Dutch team.
Dutch, yeah. So three new teams. So actually, it looks really quite healthy. I mean, I still can't really get my head around it all, how those boats are going to actually sail or... But I'm sure there's people a lot smarter than me that have got their head around it. And so I'm sure they've got their numbers right. But that's also a little bit, a bit scary, isn't it, to think that they're going to be racing these boats in September or something and they're not even on the water. and you've got a whole new world of sailing to learn. But they got the best in the business working on it. I mean, their team's starting late. That I can only assume they're getting a lot of support design-wise. Otherwise, I think it's surely going to be too big a mountain to climb. But as I say, I'm not that close to it. But to answer your question, what's that? 1, 2, 3, is that 7 or 8 teams? Well, whether it's 7 or 8, either way, it's a good number and it's going to be a hell of a spectacle. So, it might be time to think about flights to New Zealand in 2021, is it?
2021.
Yeah, I've got a little while, year till the flights come out. But yeah, it's going to be quite a spectacle. I think they're racing at Cowes. Are they racing at Cowes? Oh, no, that's the CLGP are racing at Cowes.
Yeah, CLGP will race at Cowes.
They'll both be an amazing spectacle, for good or for bad.
Ian, thanks a million for talking to me. I've got a whole bunch of other questions we could ask, but I don't want to take up your time at the RYA for too much longer. So I'll say thanks, and we'll hopefully check in with you later in the year and just get an update on that British Olympic team.
Good stuff, Justin. Following your website, enjoying your podcast. So keep up the good work.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. Thanks to my guest, Ian Walker, Director of Racing at the RYA, and thanks to you too for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing to the podcast. You can do that for free. And if you can spare a few seconds to give it a star rating and, if possible, leave a review, I will be eternally grateful. I'll be back soon with another episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. But until then, thanks again for listening and sail fast.